As Rebecca returns home after her social triumph at the Marquis of Staines ball, her husband, Colonel Crawley, is arrested for debt. He is then driven to the debt collector's dismal mansion in Cursitor Street, where he's welcomed by his expectant host, Mr. Moss. Such are the contrasts of Vanity Fair.
Damn it. I've not been here since I was a bachelor. Then, God help me, my aunt bailed me out.
You'll find everything much as it was, Colonel, and everything comfortable. You may be pretty sure it's kept aired and by the best of company, too. Oh, that bed was slept in the night before last by the Honourable Captain Famish of the 50th Dragoons. Ah. His ma took him out after a fortnight just to punish him.
Well, I don't think I'm going to be bothering you that long. It's only a debt of £136.08.
Don't you feel you have to hurry away, Colonel? It's very sociable here. Everything very modestly priced.
Thank you, Mr. Moss, but I expect to be out of here in no time.
Most people do. Well, if there's anything you need, we can usually find it. At a price, of course.
Well, maybe pen and ink. Oh and paper, of course. Oh,
right away, Colonel. Yeah.
Dear Becky, last night, as I was coming home smoking, I was nabbed by Moss, the debt collector, from whose gilded and splendid premises I write this. It is Nathan's business, a debt of 150, with costs 170. So, as soon as you get this, drive to Nathan's, offer him 75 down and ask him to renew. We must have the sum tonight. If word gets around I'm here, then other creditors will put charges out against me. God bless you. Yours in haste, R.C. Yeah. P.S. Make haste and come.
The letter's gone off, Colonel.
Oh, thank you, Moss.
Of course, the messenger takes no responsibility for the outcome. Gentlemen here are often cruelly disappointed.
Not me, Moss. Becky will come through. 3 hours, I calculate, will be the utmost time before she arrives and opens my prison doors.
Well, if anything goes wrong, don't forget that Mrs. Moss's table d'hote is served at 5:30. More eel pie, Colonel?
No, thank you.
I remember you as a real trencherman.
I'm not hungry.
For Rawdon cannot stop rereading the letter which has just arrived. It's a thing of beauty. Pink paper, light green seal. But its contents spoil his appetite.
Mon pauvre cher petit. I could not sleep one wink for thinking of what had become of you and only got to rest in the morning after sending for Mr. Blench, for I was in a fever, who gave me a composing draught. I was therefore hors de combat for some hours, and you may fancy my state when I read your poor dear ill-spelt letter.
Oh, Becky.
I went straight to Mr. Nathan's. I saw him, I wept, I cried, I fell at his odious knees. Nothing would mollify the horrid man. He would have all the money, he said, or keep my poor dear in prison. So I drove home with the intention of selling all I had to the pawnbroker. But when I got home, I found my Lord Steyne there.
Oh, don't do this to me, Becky.
My Lord was there with some terrible old aristocratic harridans who had come to compliment me on my performance last night in the charades. When they were gone, I went on my knees to my Lord Steyne. I told him we were going to pawn everything and begged and prayed him to give me £200. He pished and pshawed in fury and told me not to be such a fool as to pawn. At last he went away, promising that he would send it to me on Sunday morning, when I will bring it to my poor monster with a kiss from his affectionate Becky.
Shall I take the pie away, Colonel?
Yes, of course. She says the money will be here tomorrow.
Your wife, you mean?
Usually she's full of schemes. Such a small amount, I just don't understand. She won't even go out and sell her trinkets to save me.
Oh.
Moss.
Colonel.
Bring me more writing paper.
My dear brother and sister-in-law, for the sake of God, for the sake of my dear son and my honour, come and relieve me of this difficulty. I am in prison. I need £100 to set me free. Please, please come.
Later that evening, the Colonel falls into a fitful slumber.
Colonel Crawley.
What? Yes.
There's a lady here to see you.
Becky!
No, Rawdon. It's your sister-in-law.
Lady Jane? Why?
I received your message.
Oh, God bless you, Jane.
No, it's nothing. But Sir Pitt is out tonight, so I took it upon myself to come and see you.
You're a good woman, Jane.
Oh, Rawdon, please, don't become tearful.
It's just that since I've known you and since I've had my son, I've not been the way I was. I don't want to be the fellow I used to be. Do you understand me?
Of course I do. You have changed, and changed so much. You're a good man, Rawdon.
Damn it, Jane. Now it's you that's getting a fellow too emotional. No, it's just that I want to be...
What?
Someone like you who's decent. Someone who's prepared to come and set a fellow free.
God bless you, Rawdon.
It is 11 o'clock at night when Rawdon leaves Mr. Moss's establishment. He walks through the great squares of Vanity Fair and at length comes up breathless opposite his own house. The drawing room windows are blazing with light.
She said she was ill and in bed. Anyone there? Trotter? Fifine?
But nobody is stirring. Have the servants been sent away?
Brother Becky!
Stain.
Oh, Rawdon, they let you out. Thank goodness!
Yes. Lady Jane brought me the money.
Well, glad to see you back. How do you do, Crawley?
But Rawdon ignores my lord's outstretched hand. Becky sits, her fingers sparkling with bracelets and rings and the brilliance on her breast which Stain has given her.
I am innocent, Rawdon. Before God, I am innocent.
What? Innocent? Look at you.
This is not fair. I have done nothing wrong. My lord, say I am innocent. My lord.
Oh, and now I see. You've planned it all, haven't you? The pair of you are out to blackmail me.
My lord.
You innocent. I have given you thousands of pounds which this fellow here has spent and for which he sold you. Innocent, by God. You're both in on the arrangement, aren't you?
That's enough.
Don't think you can lay a trap for me. You don't frighten me.
Look, stay there.
You make way, sir. Let me pass. I've had enough of both you and your cheating ways.
I said enough.
What a pair. A pimp and a whore.
That's not true.
Let me go, you ruffian.
You are a coward and a liar. I know nothing of your money. I have sold nothing to you. I am not a blackmailer. You...
Oh, stop! Stop! Stop!
Have you had enough, my lord?
Oh, Rawdon, why weren't you like this before?
Becky, come here.
Yes, Rawdon.
Take off that jewellery.
Yes, Rawdon.
She removes her gold serpents, her rings, her fingers shaking.
Now throw them down. Now take off that damned bauble.
He tears the diamond ornament out of her breast and flings it at Lord Steyne. It cuts him on his bald forehead. He wears the scar to his dying day.
And now, my lord, get out of my house.
I'll make you pay for this, you oaf. You blackguard, you...
Get out! And if you want to send your seconds round, they know where they can find me.
Rawdon, is this wise? If you fight a duel...
Come upstairs.
Then... Don't kill me, please.
What sort of fellow do you think I am?
It's just that...
I want to know if that man lies about the money as he lied about me. Has he given you any?
No. That is...
Give me your keys. How about this desk?
But... It's just paper. And all sorts of trinkets. Nothing important. Some old love letters from many years ago before I met you. And...
So, what's this?
It's a pocketbook.
Yes. With banknotes in it.
Well, they're old. 10 years back.
Well, this seems quite fresh. A note for £1,000.
Yes,
did he give you this? Did he give you this?
Yes.
Then I shall send it back to him. For the rest, I'll use it to pay back poor old Briggs, who's always been kind to little Rawdy, and some of the debts. Is that fair?
Yes, oh yes.
What's left, I shall send on to you, when you know where you will be.
What are you saying?
Once it was us against the world, not anymore. Too many lies have been told. We will never see each other again.
Rawdon.
You know, you might have spared me £100 of all this to get me out of Cursitor Street. I've always shared with you.
I know. But you must believe me, Rawdon. I am innocent.
Goodbye, Becky.
She remains alone on the bed's edge. The drawers are all opened and their contents scattered about. A heap of tumbled vanities lying in a wreck.
What is going to happen to me? To Rawdon? What if he does meet Lord Steyne in a duel? What then? Try to sleep, Becky. Try to sleep.
His mind in turmoil, Colonel Rawdon Crawley spends a sleepless night pacing the streets. The next morning, Sir Pitt Crawley enters his study to find his brother sitting there.
Good gracious, Rawdon. You're up early, not your usual style. Why aren't you at home?
Oh.
You look awful. You might at least have shaved. And those clothes seem as if you've slept in them. Are you...
No, Pitt, I'm not drunk. Would you shut the door? I need to speak to you. Pitt, it's all over with me. I'm done.
Well, I warned you 1,000 times, and I'm sorry, but I can't help you any more. Every shilling of my money is...
It's not money I want.
You're not asking me for money?
I've not come to you about myself. I don't care what happens to me.
And what do you want?
It's the boy. I want you to promise to take care of Rawdy when I'm gone.
Gone?
That dear good wife of yours had always been good to him, and he's fonder of her than he is of his mother. Oh, damn it, Pitt.
You know that if I hadn't married her, then I would have had Miss Crawley's money, so...
Your marriage was your own doing, not mine.
Well, it's over now, quite over.
Good God. Is Rebecca dead?
No, no, but I wish I was. If it wasn't for little Rawdy, I'd have cut my throat this morning, and that damned villain Staines, too.
Cut my lord's throat? I don't understand.
Oh, Pitt. It was a regular plan between that scoundrel and her. The bailiffs were put on to me, and when I got home, I found her in diamonds, sitting with that villain alone. I hit him several times. So there can be only one issue, a duel.
No!
As it may end fatally for me, and as the boy has no mother, I must leave him to you and Jane. It will be a comfort to me if you promise to be his friend.
But I will, upon my honour.
Here's money. Didn't know I was so rich, did you? I've only kept back this one note.
But it's for £1,000.
And it will be a fine revenge to wrap a ball in it and kill the man to whom it belongs.
Becky, however, does not rally from her stupor and confusion until the afternoon. But when she rings for her maid... she rings in vain. Hearing sounds below, Mrs. Crawley flings her morning robe round her and goes to investigate.
What is going on? How dare you all stay here when you heard me call? You've all been drinking too. Trotter, get up. How dare you sit in my presence?
I was thinking, ma'am, that I'm going to sit here until I'm paid my wages. Yeah, right. Even if that's a precious long time.
That's right.
Where's my maid?
She left hours ago. She must have found some very rich pickings.
Yeah. Pay us our salaries and we'll follow her soon enough.
Yeah. Are you all here to insult me? When Colonel Crawley comes home?
He ain't coming back.
I don't believe he's no more a colonel than I am. You're no better than swindlers, both of you.
How dare you suggest...
And your credit's worth nothing now, is it? So yeah. We're not moving till you pay us what's owing. And you're not leaving the house either.
I thought Colonel Crawley had settled with you. He will tomorrow. I declare to you, upon my honour, that he left home this morning with £1,500 in his pocketbook. And I promise you, upon my word, that you will all be paid.
With what?
You don't understand. The Colonel has got a magnificent new appointment with a large salary. It'll be in today's papers. We had a difference this morning, but that'll blow over. Let me get dressed and go out and find him. That's all it needs.
While the servants argue over this audacious statement, Becky discreetly slips from the house. But of course, she does not go in search of her husband, who sits disconsolately in his club.
There's the no way out, old boy. It's only suspicion, you know. I mean, there aren't any letters, are there?
Rawdon had sought out as his second Captain McMurdo, a veteran of Waterloo, a venerable, bristly warrior with a great dyed moustache.
Once you start up a scandal, there's no controlling it. Oh, it serves him right, of course. They do say he... I mean, they said you...
Well, what the devil are you saying? Do you mean you ever heard a fellow doubt my wife and didn't tell me, man?
Well, the world's very censorious. There's always talk.
But behind my back...
Now, you hold up now, easy. Great man or not, we'll put a bullet in him, damn him. As for women, well, what can you do?
You don't know how fond I was of that one. Damn it, I followed her like a footman. I gave up everything I had to her.
Well, she may be innocent after all.
Oh, she was never innocent. I'm just glad little Rawdy isn't at home.
Oh, no, 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 old boy.
Later in the day, Sir Pitt is taking a constitutional in his garden when he sees a familiar figure hurrying across the lawn.
Rebecca? Who let you in?
I made use of the garden gate. I'm sorry, but I have to see you. I am not guilty.
That is not what Rawdon says.
Everything is against me, and just at the moment when all my hopes were to be realised, just when happiness was in store for us.
What are you talking about?
I own freely Lord Steyne's partiality for me. I admit that I did everything in my power to make myself pleasing to him, and as far as an honest woman could, secure his esteem. But it was all in a good cause.
What can possibly justify...
Well, among other things... I was looking for a peerage for you, Pitt. I discussed it with Lord Steyne. Your eloquent genius and Lord Steyne's interest made a peerage more than probable. Had not this terrible calamity put pay to all our hopes? But my first object, of course, was to rescue my dear husband.
This is all very well, Rebecca.
No, but... please, let me finish. It was only on Friday morning that the news arrived of the death of the governor of Coventry Island. It was what we had been hoping for. And my lord instantly secured the appointment for Rawdon. It was intended as a surprise for him. But then he was arrested and came home and everything went terribly wrong.
Is this appointment some invention of yours?
If you look in today's paper, you will see that it is true. Finally, I had achieved what I wished. Oh, Pitt. Dear Pitt, pity me and reconcile us.
Pitt? They told me this intruder was here. I am surprised... that you have received her.
Tell her she does not know all. Dear Pitt.
Indeed, Jane. I believe Rebecca to be...
To be what? To be a heartless mother.
Jane.
A false wife. She never loved her dear little boy who used to fly here to tell me of her cruelty to him. She has deceived her husband as she has deceived everyone else.
Lady Jane, this is too much.
I have been a true and faithful wife to you. I have kept my marriage vow as I made it to God. But righteous obedience has its limits. If she enters this house, I and my children leave. Her soul is black with vanity. She is not worthy to sit with Christian people. You must choose, sir, between her and me.
After his wife leaves, Sir Pitt mumbles and promises and blusters. But Becky knows that her last chance of salvation in London is now gone.
What? Damn it, Nat, listen to this. Following the death from fever of the esteemed governor of Coventry Island, we hear that the governorship has been offered to Colonel Rawdon Crawley, a distinguished Waterloo officer. We need not only men of acknowledged bravery, but men of administrative talent and impeccable moral character to superintend the affairs of our colonies.
What? Any idea this was going to happen?
None.
Oh, we know where Coventry Island is.
Not the faintest idea.
Excuse me, sirs. Mr. Wenham is here.
Oh, Mr. Wenham? Who the devil is he?
He is the representative of Lord Steyne. I assume you have seen the gratifying announcement in the papers this morning, Colonel. 3,000 a year, delightful climate, excellent government house. I congratulate you with all my heart. I presume you know to whom you're indebted for this piece of patronage. To one of the most generous men in the world. To my excellent friend, the Marquis of Steyne.
I'll see him damned before I accept.
You are irritated against my noble friend. So now, in the name of common sense and justice, tell me why.
Why?
You come home and find my Lord Steyne supping with Mrs. Crawley. Has he not been a guest in your house 100 times?
Well, yes, but...
Excuse me, sir. But are you saying that Crawley is somehow mistaken?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I believe that Mrs. Crawley is as innocent as my own wife. I believe that, misled by an infernal jealousy, my friend here strikes a blow against not only an infirm... an old man of high station, his constant friend and benefactor, but against his wife, his own dearest honour, his son's future reputation, and his own prospect in life.
He won't escape like this.
Now, Crawley, hear the fellow out. When I first saw him, his lordship was in a pitiable state. But he was as anxious as you are to revenge the outrage committed upon him by blood. You know Lord Steyne is no coward in these matters, Colonel.
No, he's plenty of pluck.
Nobody ever said he hadn't. His first order to me was to write a letter of challenge. One or other of us, he said, must not survive the outrage of the night.
Come to the point, Wenham.
Oh, how I regret that Mrs. Wenham and myself had not accepted Mrs. Crawley's invitation to sup with her.
What?
Oh, yes. If one of Mrs. Wenham's headaches had not prevented us, we would have been present, and you could not possibly have deemed the circumstances in which you found my lord and your wife suspicious. Somewhere at home, I still have the invitation. My wife, as you can imagine, is mortified that a headache of hers could...
I don't believe a word of this.
You must let him finish, Colonel.
Thank you, Major McMurdo. There is another aspect to this matter. The days of dueling are surely over. It's a barbaric way of settling differences. A duel between the two of you must lead to the disgrace of all parties concerned, including your beloved son. I implored my lord not to send the challenge.
This is all a damned lie, and you're in it, Mr. Wenham. And if the challenge don't come from him, then by Jove, it shall come from me.
Not if I'm concerned, it won't.
But he wants...
You put the affair in my hands, and you shall act as I think fit. I've listened carefully to what Mr. Wenham has to say, and it makes sense to me.
But Mac...
You have no right to insult Mr. Wenham. If my lord, after being thrashed, chooses to sit still, damn me, let him. And as for the affair with Mrs. Crawley, there's nothing proved, so your wife's as innocent as Mr. Wenham says she is.
You're asking me to...
Crawley... If only for the sake of your son, you'd be a damned fool not to take the place and hold your tongue.
She has kept money concealed from me these 10 years. She swore she had none from Stain. She knew it was all up directly I found it. If she's not guilty, Matt, she's as bad as guilty. And I'll never see her again. Never.
So be it.
In the end, Colonel Crawley reluctantly agrees to take up his glittering new appointment in Coventry Island, still with only the vaguest idea of where he is going. He takes a tearful farewell of his son on the playing fields of Whitefriars, leaving him to the care of Sir Pitt and Lady Jane. But he never sets eyes on his wife again. For Mrs. Crawley has left England too. But where she has gone is, for the moment, a matter of the deepest mystery. The years go by for poor Amelia, ignored by the grander inhabitants of Vanity Fair. She lives in genteel poverty with her ruined father, forced by circumstances to yield up her son, the apple of her eye, to her wealthy father-in-law, Mr. Osborne. But then, one day, there's an unexpected visitor.
Yes?
Does Mrs. Osborne live here? I mean, if she still is Mrs. Osborne, that is, if you see what I mean.
Well, she was the last time I looked, sir. Who shall I say is calling?
Say it's Major Dobbin.
Very good, sir.
I'm George's godfather, and I've just come from India. Is that Mrs. Osborne playing her piano?
Oh, yes, sir. It's her pride and joy.
I'm very pleased to hear it.
William, how delightful to see you.
And you, Amelia. You've not changed.
Oh, you're kind, but I'm older now.
You're as I remember you. Whereas I...
You've been ill.
I was coming home... I'd been given leave. I had heard from my sisters that... well, anyway, I got malaria. It delayed my return for quite a few months.
I'm sorry.
So, a bit thinner, a lot greyer. But then nobody ever called me a handsome man.
And what about Miss Glorvina O'Dowd?
What about her?
Forgive me, but I thought you had become engaged to her. Your sisters told me
My sisters were wrong. In fact, I think if she'd been around when I was ill, Miss O'Dowd would have done for me. She is so very anxious to be married. But then...
What?
My sisters told me that you had become engaged too. To a doctor. Dr. Linton, I think that was his name.
Oh, I don't know why they said that. He was a very good friend to us in difficult times, but he has married a Miss Gritz. Her papa is a grocer, so she is rather rich.
You're not disappointed?
Of course not.
I'm glad to hear it.
There has only ever been one man for me. Dear, brave George, your friend and my beloved. Mm. Nobody will ever take his place in my heart. Nobody.
No, no. I know they won't.
Major Dobbin. They've only just told me you were here.
It's good to see you, sir.
I'm sorry that you see me now in such reduced circumstances. Fate has dealt me some cruel blows, but I continue to fight against them. One day, no doubt, I will rebuild the family name.
Father.
What?
There is no need to burden Major Dobbin with these matters.
Forgive me, sir, but help may be at hand.
What do you mean?
Your son Joss travelled back in the same ship as me.
Joss?
Joss!
Home?
Yes, he's coming back to take care of you.
Then why isn't he here yet? You are?
Well, I suppose after the long and indeed rather uncomfortable voyage from India on HMS Ramchunder, he needed some time to relax in a comfortable bed in Southampton.
Wow, what a fat, lazy, selfish boy.
Father, please.
But it's true, he's never...
If you will allow me to interrupt you, sir, I had a number of conversations during our voyage with Joseph. He made clear to me that he understood the duty he had to make your life comfortable now that he is returning to London, with his Indian duties complete and a comfortable sum of money to his name.
God send that it is true. It galls me, Amelia, that you continue to take money from that ungrateful monster Osborne.
Father.
But it's only the truth. He stole my grandson away, Major. And now he patronizes us from the fortune I helped him to earn. Imagine having to be beholden to that man for anything.
Eventually, old Mr. Sedley's rage abates, and he falls asleep. Amelia is at last free to talk to Major Dobbin about her favourite subject, her darling son, Georgie.
You are his godfather, and so I feel free to tell you how proud I am of how he has turned out. It was terrible when he had to go away. It was as if a limb had been torn from my body. If only you could have been here to help.
Oh, how I wish I had been.
Still, I have to believe it was all for the best. And of course he comes to see me as often as he can.
I'd expect no less.
You must go and see him at his school.
Of course.
He is quite the young gentleman now. He rides, he entertains his friends regally. He is full of confidence and charm.
Forgive me, but I must ask, is there any danger of him becoming spoiled?
Spoiled?
Mr. Osborne, as I recall, is a powerful and ambitious man. He wanted so much for his son. I just hope that, well, he's not overindulging his grandson.
Dear William, there is no danger of Georgie becoming anything but a worthy son to his father. For all his faults, Mr. Osborne has spared nothing in Georgie's upbringing.
No doubt.
Please, William, don't judge too harshly. Georgie has all sorts of advantages which I could not possibly give to him. But believe me, he is not spoiled. Look at this.
He's a handsome boy.
Yes. And I had a little black profile done for a shilling. I put it out beside his father's portrait over my bed. And then, one day, Georgie came to me and pulled out a Morocco case. He'd had this miniature of himself done. Very handsomely done, though it doesn't do him justice. And he'd paid for it out of his own money and brought it to me. Oh, he is the very image of his father.
He is indeed.
Eventually, after a leisurely journey from Southampton, Joseph Sedley arrives in London, his clothing more elaborate and resplendent than ever before.
My dear Emmy, this place is so cramped, so squalid, and the noise is simply frightful.
Father is very proud. He didn't want you to know he'd sold the annuity you set up.
I'm not surprised, since he squandered it on his harebrained schemes. All the same, to think that you've come to this. Really, I had no idea.
Joss, you could have asked.
Yes, well, that's in the past now. The question is the future. The fact is, on the voyage home, Major Dobbin made a dashed long speech about families and obligations. Told me you and Papa were my responsibility, given that I am a man of means.
And are you?
Emmy, I have been the chief magistrate of Ramgunge in the Presidency of Bengal for a number of years. I've served my country faithfully and, apart from anything else, witnessed the horrors of Waterloo at first hand.
But, Joss, you weren't a soldier.
I know George died on the field of Waterloo, but those of us who were there in Brussels at the time still wear our scars with pride.
But, Joss, you ran away from Brussels.
Emmy, you know nothing of these things. And if you wish me to help our father and yourself to a better home, you'd be wise not to pursue this subject.
No, of course not, Joseph.
Because I have already found myself a fashionable London house. It's situated in St. Martin's Lane, admirably close to all the theatre. I intend to accommodate you and our father there.
Oh, thank you, Joss, thank you.
You cannot live any longer in this hovel. It's a disgrace to the name of Sedley.
And so Amelia begins the business of packing, unable to believe how much paper her father has crammed into such a small space. But Polly the maid is in a more playful frame of mind.
Pass me that plate, please, Polly.
Oh, but really, you should have seen his face, ma'am. He seemed so very anxious when he asked, "Is she still Mrs. Osborne?"
I asked you not to keep talking about the major. Pass me the next plate, please.
But you must notice, ma'am, for all his grey hairs, he looks for all the world like a love-struck schoolboy.
Polly, that is quite enough. Father, will you come and give a hand, please? The Major was my husband's dearest friend, and he is Georgie's guardian, so let's have no more of such talk.
Emmy, what's happening?
I've explained to you, Papa. We're going to Joss's new house.
But I can't find my papers. It's important. The projects I was working on last week aren't where I left them.
Father, I told you. They've all been packed.
What?
I've packed them away. When we get to Joss's house, you'll find them all again.
I want them now.
Oh, they're there, Papa.
I beg your pardon. I didn't mean to intrude.
William, I didn't see you there. Come in.
Good morning, Mr. Sedley.
Come on, Father, sit down over here. So, tell me, how did you find Georgie?
He's well. He seemed to recognise me. We had a good chat. He seems to be doing well enough at school, but his teachers say he's a bit lazy and needs to knuckle down more.
They can't mean it.
Well, I passed their comments on to Georgie and he seemed to take it in good spirits. Quite the accomplished little gentleman. Can I help in any way?
Oh, yes, thank you.
The trunks and bandboxes are soon safely disposed of in the smart new house. And out with the furniture comes Amelia's now battered old piano, which she places in her new sitting room.
It'll need tuning, of course.
I'm glad you've kept it.
What do you mean?
I was afraid you didn't care about it.
I value it more than anything I have in the world.
Do you? Do you?
How can I do otherwise? When Father went bankrupt and the big house was put up to sale, George bought it back at the auction and had it sent to me.
Did he? I didn't know that.
It was George who sent it to me, wasn't it?
It's possible. I really don't know.
It was you, wasn't it? I can see it in your face. Oh. All these years I've cherished it as George's gift and now it seems it came from you. I don't know what to say. I suppose I must say thank you, William. But I don't want to play just now.
Amelia, please don't go like this. Yes. I did buy it for you. I loved you then as I do now.
William, please!
No! I have to speak. I think I have loved you from the very first minute I saw you. I think there is no hour in the day which has passed for 12 years that I haven't thought of you. I wanted to tell you all this before I went to India, but you were full of Georgie and I hadn't the heart to speak. You didn't care whether I stayed or went.
You make me sound very ungrateful.
No, only indifferent. I know I have nothing to make a woman to be otherwise. But perhaps now I've returned, things will be different. Perhaps I may hope that finally there is a chance that you will listen to my love.
I won't. I can't.
I have to ask your pardon for being a fool for a moment and thinking that years of constancy and devotion might have pleaded with you.
Now it is you who are being cruel. George is my husband, here and in heaven. He was the one who taught me to love you as a brother. Have you not been to my boy and to me the dearest, kindest friend and protector?
I've tried to be.
Oh, if you'd not fallen ill, perhaps you might have come back before and spared me that dreadful parting from my son. It nearly killed me, William. But you didn't come, though I wished and prayed for you to come, and they took him away from me. But he is a noble boy, isn't he, William? You've seen how noble he is. Please, be still his friend and mine.
What else can I do? I want to keep your esteem more than anything. Only, please, let me stay near you. And see you often?
Oh, yes. Often. Of course.
And so William Dobbin remains at liberty to look and to long. Like the poor boy at school who has no money but still sighs for the content of the tart woman's tray. The Marquis of Staines sits in his study. A scar makes a burning white mark on his white, bald, shining forehead. His eyes glitter.
Go on, Wenham.
My informants tell me that Mrs. Rawdon Crawley has become a vagabond upon the face of the earth. She flits from Paris to Brussels, the scenes of her former triumphs, but stays nowhere long.
So, is she starving?
She has little money and less credit, so she attaches herself to gamblers, seedy majors and colonels who are no more military officers than I am, your lordship.
And yet she was so proud with me, who gave her everything she asked for.
There is something else I should mention.
What?
Mrs. Crawley is currently in Rome for the winter season. If you make your planned trip there to visit the casino, then you...
Wenham. Do I need to tell you what to do?
Mrs. Crawley! Mrs. Crawley!
Why, Mr. Wenham, what a small world. What are you doing in Rome?
Are you aware that Lord Steyne is planning to spend the winter here recuperating?
What is that to me?
I really would not advise you to take this tone, Mrs. Crawley. In fact, I would not advise you to stay around in Rome at all. The climate can be very unhealthy this time of year. There's always malaria for some people.
For some, but not for others? Mr. Wenham, surely there's not a plot afoot to assassinate poor little me. How romantic.
We know everything about you, Mrs. Crawley. Whom you saw at Paris, and whom you saw at Brussels, and the nature of your relationship with them.
But...
Yes, you may stare. How was it that no minister on the continent would receive Mrs. Crawley? She had offended somebody who never forgives. Leave Rome.
Thank you for the advice, Mr. Wenham. But I have those who will defend me.
Oh, you mean your companions, Captain Rook and Major Loder? It'll take your best efforts to keep them sober and out of prison. Oh, remind me, which regiments were they in? Or do they just wear the uniform in the evening?
I have always made my own decisions. Lord Steyne shall not prevent me. I am staying in Rome.
Back in England, the soul of ruined John Sedley finally leaves its aged body. Clutching his daughter's hand, life and disappointment and vanity sink away from under him. His death leads inevitably to a meeting between Major Dobbin, his grandson's nominated guardian, and Mr. Osborne, the surviving grandfather in whose house Georgie now lives.
You see, Major, what comes of industry and judicious speculation. Look at me, and look at John Sedley, and yet this day, 20 years ago, he was a better man than I am by, I should say, £10,000.
It depends upon what you mean by a better man. You rejected your son, and you continue to reject his widow.
I shall ignore that remark, Major. because reluctantly I have come to respect you. I'm staggered by what I've learned by going through the old accounts for your ward, my grandson. A part of the fund that allowed my son's widow and her son to subsist came out of your own pocket.
I felt responsible, because I told George that he had gone so far that retreat from his engagement would have been a grave dishonour.
Major, you did me a great injury by encouraging that marriage. Who knows what George might have achieved without the burden of that penniless woman?
Yes, sir. You don't know what Mrs. George Osborne has endured over the years. When she believed it was her duty, she gave up Georgie to you. And I can tell you, however much you loved your dead son, she loved her living one 10 times more.
Sir, you speak your mind, and I respect that. You were always a good friend to my son.
George was such a noble fellow that all of us loved him and would have done anything for him. I never saw his equal for pluck and daring and all the qualities of a soldier. And you know that Georgie is like him.
He's so like him that it makes me tremble sometimes. Forgive me.
Very soon, the word in Vanity Fair is that rich old Mr. Osborne is failing. His doctors talk of bloodletting and the seaside. But despite their advice, or perhaps because of it, Mr. Osborne sickens and dies. His son's letter from the eve of Waterloo clasped in his hand. And though his funeral is magnificent, he is as gone from the world as poverty-stricken Mr. Sedley. The provisions of his will inevitably attract great attention.
So, Emmy, once Miss Osborne is provided for, half of the property is left to your son in his own right.
I had no idea.
There's more. An annuity of £500 chargeable upon George's property is left to his mother. That's you. And you are to resume guardianship of the boy.
Oh, Georgie has returned to me. What miracle has taken place? Oh, this is your doing, William.
I only said what needed to be said.
Well, it must have been to some effect, Dobbin, since you're the executor. Damn it, Emmy, you're a rich woman. All those old snobs who've looked down their noses at you whilst I was in India won't be able to ignore you anymore.
Oh, just that means nothing to me. What really matters is that my husband's father was reconciled to me and gave Georgie back to me.
Soon afterwards, Amelia has the chance to visit the room which belongs to her son and which her husband many years ago inhabited.
It's so strange to be here again.
There's a G.O. scratched on the glass with a diamond. Did you know it was there?
No. Oh, dear George.
You can do what you like now.
I know. But I have no interest in the company of all the rich ladies who ignored me in my years of poverty. To be among such people is not good for Georgie either.
You could go away. Travel?
I would like that very much. It would be good to get away from London.
I would be happy to accompany you.
But what of Georgie's education?
I know enough to be his tutor in most subjects. If Georgie would agree.
Oh, Georgie adores you. But then there's Joss.
Joss will go anywhere where there is good food and fine company.
Rebecca, meanwhile, defies Mr. Wenham's advice and stays in Rome. And then one evening, she is in the casino, and he is there.
My lord?
You. Get out of my sight.
I have every right to be here.
Get away from me.
You cannot dictate to me.
You see this mark on my forehead? It's still there. It will always be there. That is you. That is what you did to me. Leave here, you whore. Or regret it forever.
But I don't see why I should...
Go! Damn you! Go! Go!
My lord's eyes burn with madness. Rebecca flees from the casino, from Rome.
Says here the Marquis of Steyne is dead.
Who?
A knight of the most noble order of the Garter, the Golden Fleece of Spain, first lord of the Powder Closet and groom of the Backstairs.
I care nothing for the
Marquis. His body was buried at Rome, where he died after a series of fits. But his heart, that heart which always beat with every generous and noble emotion, was brought back to Castle Gaunt in a silver urn. Of course, rumour says that your friend Rebecca and Steyne were...
She is not my friend anymore.
I'm so sorry, Emmy. I'm going back many years when...
When you almost married Rebecca.
That is a blow below the belt, Major. Where did you spring from?
From giving Georgie lessons in mathematics.
Well, now that we're all together, I must tell you that I've been taking informed opinion about where to spend our winter. Somewhere which is both fashionable and congenial, both healthy and stimulating.
And the answer?
The Grand Duchy of Pumpernickel am Rhein.
And indeed, Pumpernickel proves an ideal choice for the whole party. Here, enchanted, Amelia hears for the first time the great works of Mozart and Beethoven. She also goes sketching and painting with the faithful Major Dobbin carrying about her stool and sketchbook. And young Georgie is free to explore Pumpernickel and discover the delights that await him as a young gentleman of independent and ample means.
Lord Tapeworm, how delightful to see you. And dear Lady Tapeworm. Yeah, you were asking me about Waterloo, I recall.
But perhaps the happiest of all is Joss, who spends his days among the cream of the small English aristocratic set. And when he desires a change of scene, he visits the gaming halls, where roulette is played. One evening, Joss sees a woman in a black mask at the tables. He stands just behind her and watches her play and lose.
Hope to bring me luck, monsieur. Sit down here beside me.
Well, if you insist, madame.
There's my money. Where's yours?
Here. Beside yours.
I play to forget, but I cannot. I cannot forget old times, monsieur.
Do I know you from somewhere?
Maybe you're not much changed from when I knew you before. Well, yes, you are in a way. Everybody changes, everybody forgets. Nobody has a heart.
Good God, who are you?
Can't you guess, Joseph Sedley? Surely you recognize me now.
Good heavens! Mrs. Crawley!
Oh, Rebecca, please. I'm stopping at the Elephant Inn, by the way. You ask there for Madame de Rodon.
How does Mrs. Crawley guess that Joseph Sedley's curiosity will bring him to her lodgings? They are squalid and noisy, but Rebecca retains her allure.
Have you been in Pumpernickel long?
Long enough. I saw my dear Amelia the other day from afar. How pretty she looked and how happy. And of course Major Dobbin is still in attendance with his sweet but clumsy ways. He looked happy too. And you look happy. Only I am wretched.
But why are you wretched, Mrs...
Rebecca.
Rebecca, what is the matter?
I have had so many griefs and wrongs. I've been made to suffer so cruelly that I'm almost mad sometimes. All my friends have been false to me.
Surely not.
Yes, all. I was the truest wife that ever lived. Though really I only married my husband out of pique because somebody else treated me so cruelly when I first came to London and...
You don't mean that.
I was true, and my husband trampled upon me and deserted me. I was the fondest mother. I had but one child, one darling, one hope, one joy, which I held to my heart with a mother's affection. But they tore him from me. Tore him from me.
I had no idea.
How could you? You're a man.
Maybe I have misunderstood you.
I think you always did. When I came with your sister from school to stay with her, I was scarcely more than a child. I should not say it. But you were the first man I laid eyes upon whom I knew I could love and respect. But no, I mustn't talk of it.
You feel I abandoned you? What can I do to recompense you for that?
that betrayal?
I don't know. But give me time. Perhaps I can think of something.
How can anyone be glad she's here? Mrs. Rawdon Crawley brings mischief wherever she goes.
To Joss Sedley's dismay, the news of Rebecca's presence in Pumpernickel appalls Major Dobbin.
Who knows what sort of disreputable life she's been leading? And how can she be here abroad and alone?
But, Major, if you could hear how she has suffered.
An honest woman always has friends and is never separated from her family.
You are being overly harsh.
Let us consult Amelia. She won't forget the past so easily.
Emmy is well enough, but...
Well, I'm sure you'll allow that she is a good judge of what is right in such matters.
Oh. Don't let me see her. I couldn't see her.
Exactly. She is a woman whom I dislike very much, and you have no cause to love.
But she is very unhappy and that sort of thing. She's very poor and unprotected, and she's been ill, exceedingly ill. She hasn't a friend in the world, and she said she thought she might trust in you, Emmy. She's been almost mad with grief.
Oh.
She carries laudanum with her. I saw the bottle.
Amelia, surely you're not going to let this woman deceive you again?
Of course not. But she does sound unhappy.
Mm. It's all nonsense.
Well, it's not nonsense about her little boy. He's the same age as Georgie.
Oh.
The most beautiful child ever seen. A perfect angel who adored his mother. The ruffians tore him shrieking out of her arms and have never allowed him to see her again.
Oh, Joss, that is so cruel.
Amelia, don't
fall. We mustn't jump to conclusions, William.
Who is it?
Rebecca.
Oh, Amelia. Oh, my dear, good friend, you came. And Major Dobbin, too.
I'll wait for Mrs. Osborne downstairs.
So they took your darling child from you. They did. Oh, please, heaven, yours will be restored to you as a merciful providence has brought me back mine.
Amen to that. When they took little Rawdon away from me, I thought I should die. But fortunately, I had a brain fever, during which my doctor gave me up, and I recovered, and... And here I am, poor and friendless.
How old is he?
11.
11? But he must be older than that.
Oh, I know. Grief has made me forget so many things, dearest Amelia. He was 11 when they took him away from me. There's his sweet face. I've never seen it again.
Well?
The poor creature. How she has suffered.
I very much doubt it. You should have heard the comments I've heard waiting here.
She is to have the valet's room, and Payne will have to move upstairs.
You don't mean to say you are going to have that woman into the house?
She is in need, and now's the time to be of service to her. The oldest friend I ever had.
Your oldest friend? How can you call her that?
We were very close.
Have you forgotten how brazenly she flirted with George at the ball before Waterloo?
Oh.
I found you in tears over your neglect. I had to take
you to... I don't want to be reminded of such things.
Amelia? Amelia!
Poor Dobbin. A few unlucky words, and away flies the bird which he has been trying all his life to lure.
Amelia, please!
You have no right to tell me what I may or may not do, and then to insult the memory of my darling George like that. I have had enough of being told what I may or may not think. Perhaps you should go.
You mean that my rash words are to weigh against my loyalty and service, do you?
I will not have anyone, Rebecca or my dead husband, persecuted or insulted, because you, Major Dobbin, choose to do so. And it is not generous of you in these circumstances to remind me of our obligations to you.
So that is it, is it? I am sent away for trying to tell you the truth. After all these years of devotion.
I am grateful for all that you have done, but I did not ask you to devote yourself to me.
That is true. I have been fooling myself. You are not worthy of the love which I have given to you. All along I knew that the price I had set my life on was not worth the winning.
William!
You are very good-natured, and you have done your best, but you couldn't reach up to the height of the attachment which I bore you. I've been living on scraps, on hopes. But now, let it end. We're both weary of it. Goodbye, Amelia.
Am I to understand, William, that you are actually going?
Isn't that what you want? Joss will take care of you.
But, William, to part like this...
Goodbye. I've spent enough of my life at this...
William!
...play.
William!
Vanity Fair. There's a pride and a willfulness, even to a tender little parasite like Amelia. And now her devoted slave is gone. But then Mrs. Rawdon Crawley chooses to behave surprisingly well. Though, of course, motives in Vanity Fair can never be completely pure.
You know, Emmy, I worry for you.
Oh?
This social world here in Pumpernickel is all very well for me, but you're not used to it. My friends, Captain Rook and Major Loder, well, they're not the most gentlemanly of gentlemen.
They're charming to me.
Of course, you're a rich widow. But listen to me, Emmy. You've been kind to me and generous, and not many people have been that. You must get away from the impertinence of these men. You're no more fit to live in this world than a baby in arms. You must marry, or you and your precious boy will go to ruin.
I don't understand.
You must have a husband, you fool. And from what I understand, the Major has offered you 100 times, and you've rejected him, and you're wrong. Simply wrong.
You don't know what you're asking. How could I ever forget dear, devoted George?
Not forget him? That selfish humbug. That padded booby. That low-bred cockney dandy with neither wit nor manners nor heart.
How?
Why, George was weary of you and ready to jilt you. Only Dobbin forced him to keep his word.
How can you possibly know that?
Because George told me. He used to sneer about you to me, time after time. And he made love to me the week after he married you.
Rebecca, stop! This is false!
Just take a look at this, you fool. You know his handwriting. George wrote this letter to me. He wanted to run away with me. He gave it to me at that ball, the eve before Waterloo, right under your very nose, the day before he was shot, and served him right.
Well, how can you say that?
Just read.
Oh! Oh! Oh!
So, dear Emmy, forget about George and your dream of George. Some women can take care of themselves, some can't. Write to your dependable Major, and before the sharks tear you apart, marry him. Go on. Un biglietto. Hello there.
And so Amelia writes to Major Dobbin. She begs for forgiveness, and he grants it, whether from pity or from love, he no longer knows. And so, finally, they are married. Fashionable society does not bless their union, but in their quiet, rural existence, fashionable society does not concern them. Georgie is delighted, and that is enough for them.
My lawyers tell me that your brother Joseph has taken out a heavy insurance upon his life. He's been raising money to discharge debts.
But Joseph is very comfortably off.
Not anymore, apparently. And his infirmities are increasing daily.
I don't understand.
I fear I do. I've been informed that wherever Joseph travels in Europe, Mrs. Crawley travels with him. They're in Brussels just now, and he's her devoted slave.
Just as at Vauxhall, all those years ago.
None of us escape our chains.
William, I'm alarmed. Will you go and see Joseph?
What difference would it make?
Time was when you would have done anything for me.
The chains still rattle.
Major Dobbin arrives in Brussels. He makes an appointment to see Joss alone, on a night when Mrs. Crawley is elsewhere engaged.
Yes, she has been magnificent, William. She has tended me through a series of illnesses. You cannot fault her devotion. She... Well, for God's sake, do come and live near me and see me sometimes.
But forgive me, you and Rebecca are... Well, it's cohabitation. Amelia can't possibly visit you.
I swear to you...
Be a man, Joss. Break off this disreputable connection. Come home to your family. We hear your financial affairs are involved.
Involved? Who told you such calumnies? Mrs. Crawley. That is, I mean, I have laid it all out to the best interest...
So why did you insure your life?
I thought... A little present to her in case anything happened. My health is so delicate.
Joss, please, fly at once. Go anywhere. Go to India, where Mrs. Crawley will not follow you.
Yes. Yes, you're probably right. Only I need time. Please, don't say anything to Rebecca about anything. She'd kill me if she knew about your visit.
Then
go now. She's a terrible woman. I don't want her to know you've been here. Go!
Three months later, Joseph Sedley dies at Aix-la-Chapelle. The solicitor of the insurance company swears it is the blackest case he has ever seen. But Mrs. Crawley comes to London and dares the company to refuse the payment. For all the cynicism common in Vanity Fair, they can prove nothing, and they pay up. Then Rebecca's estranged husband, His Excellency Colonel Rawdon Crawley, dies of yellow fever at Coventry Island, most deeply beloved and deplored, 6 weeks before the demise of his brother, Sir Pitt. The estate consequently devolves upon the present Sir Rawdon Crawley, Bart, son of Rawdon and Rebecca Crawley. The new Sir Rawdon declines to see his mother, but he makes her a liberal allowance. The years pass. Major Dobbin and his wife, up from the country, attend a charity fair in Cheltenham in aid of the neglected washerwomen. And there, in charge of a stall, is Rebecca.
Why, Major and Mrs. Dobbin, by all that's wonderful. No, please don't run away. After all, I did bring you together.
That be counted as a happy ending. Look at me. Many people predicted that I would come to a bad end, and I haven't. I have a more than comfortable income. I support all sorts of charitable causes, and I go to church every Sunday with a footman in attendance. Perhaps my life is not as varied and exciting as I once dreamed of, but then... Which of us is happy in this world?
Which of us is happy in this world? Which of us has his desire, or having it, is satisfied? Come, children, let us put the puppets away and shut the box, for our play is played out.